You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and I'd like to welcome you to our second annual John White Forum on Manufacturing. And this forum was launched last year with the generous support of John White, who's the President and CEO of Taco Incorporated. And this is a heating pump and ventilation company in Rhode Island. Our goal is to use this event to raise awareness about manufacturing and to work towards improving the climate for manufacturing. John, his wife Liz, and sons John and Ben are here with us in the front row, so please join me in expressing our appreciation to them. And for those of you who are on Twitter, we have set up a Twitter hashtag. That'll be hashtag BIMFG, B-I-M-F-G. So any of you who would like to pose comments or questions during the course of today's events, you're welcome to do that. We will follow that, and sometimes we're able to incorporate questions into our audience Q&A. Manufacturing is one of our economy's most fundamental drivers. It is playing a major role in our current economic revival. We've seen how the adoption of advanced manufacturing techniques have improved worker productivity and how that has helped us grow our economy. Today, we are hosting a half-day conference on the exciting new innovations taking place in American manufacturing. We're going to describe some of the new developments that are transforming the sector. Manufacturing is no longer your grandfather's factory. It's not that dusty old production line that many of you might have seen on TV and in movies. It is a modern place that requires skilled workers and new styles of operation. So this morning, we're going to take a look at ways to promote a stronger economic future. We're going to start with a look at the people who are in the trenches, the people who are actually doing the innovating, and we'll talk about some of the new things that they're doing. And then later, we will look at the policies, practices, and workplace education needed to prepare us for the 21st century economy. So for our opening session, we have two very distinguished speakers. Eric Rogner leads the investment castings, forgings, extrusions, oil and gas, and defense businesses for Alcoa. That sounds like five different jobs there to me, but there probably were days where it seems that way to you, too.
No, you got it.
He has served in various executive roles since joining Alcoa in 2006. Before Alcoa, Eric was a partner with McKinsey and Company. He sits on the Finance Committee of the Board of Governors of the Aerospace Industries Association and the Finance Committee of the Board of Directors of the Ohio Manufacturers Association. To my immediate right is Tony Mataluna. He's Executive Vice President at Pfizer and President of the Pfizer Global Supply. Under Tony's leadership, Pfizer has focused on plant network strategy, ways to improve the agility of their operations, ways to improve business practices, redesign, and technology innovation in general. His career with Pfizer spans more than 35 years. He joined the company in 1975 in St. Louis.
I was only 10 at the time.
And he has served in a variety of management positions since then. He represents Pfizer on the National Association of Manufacturers and beginning in 2013 will be a member of the NAM Executive Committee. So I'm going to start with Eric. This year, Alcoa is celebrating its 125th anniversary, so clearly your company knows something about staying relevant and keeping up with change. So can you speak to how Alcoa keeps innovating its processes and its products, and specifically what the concept of advanced manufacturing means at Alcoa?
Very good. Well, first off, Darrell, thank you very much for extending the invitation to us both to be here and to the Brookings Institute and to our sponsors. We really do appreciate the opportunity to do that. You know, this year, celebrating our 125th anniversary, the exact same thing that caused Alcoa to be born is what's kept us alive and vibrant to this day. And that is a ruthless focus on process and product innovation. It was 125 years ago that Charles Martin Hall created a new process, the electrolytic reduction process, that turned aluminum from being a precious metal into really a globally available material that could be used for a wide variety of different products. That commitment to process innovation that then can create a new product is really what's carried Alcoa through all the different phases through the 20th century and into the 21st century. It has an interesting little factoid. Aluminum is one of these odd materials in that if you look around you, there are so many things that are made out of aluminum, very few of them were actually originally designed in aluminum. Aluminum is almost by definition a substitution material. From the very original pots and pans and cables into packaging, into aerospace applications. Now, if you hold up your iPhone, your iPad, you're going to see aluminum casing. Just about everywhere you go, you start to see that the ability to take a material, in those examples, aluminum, but we're going to talk about others, if you bring innovation to bear and you can solve problems that your customers either have or may not even know that they have yet, and you can bring that into the marketplace, it's that differentiation which is going to allow you to succeed. We call it advancing each generation of the different products and markets that we're in. Now, to the specific issue about manufacturing and advanced manufacturing, the way that you stay relevant as a globally competitive company is to stay globally competitive, which means you're either cheaper than other people or you can do things that other people and other companies can't do. And that means significant investment in improving your process technology or your product technology. And when we think advanced manufacturing, where we deploy our resources in R&D in particular, is figuring out how we can move those positions. I'll give you just two examples now. I'm sure we're going to talk about more later. On the process side, I mean, we have over 61,000 folks all around the world, ranging from very commodity-like businesses and refining and smelting through incredibly differentiated businesses that make the fasteners for aircraft or the blades and vanes for jet engines. On the process side of the industry, smelting of aluminum, something that's been around for 125 years, we are bringing state-of-the-art information technology. We have a thing called the Star Probe System, where on our pot lines, and you can picture these massive facilities that we have all around the world, we can collect huge amounts of data from every one of our production cells on all the process variables. We can monitor them real time across the entire facility to be optimizing and tweaking as we go. But then we can bring advanced information technology tools to study those statistical data on a massive scale across multiple variables to look for opportunities to find linkages. If a temperature here for a period of time mixed with a particular catalyst in that area, what drives different reactions? And by doing that modeling, which really even 10 years ago was physically impossible to do, something that you think of massive data mining, you might think in banking or retail, we bring that to the manufacturing environment, and we found cases of 15 to 20% improvements in energy efficiency, in input cost utilization improvements, by deploying these very sophisticated tools into core manufacturing environments. On the innovation side of product, I'll give you another example. Aerospace is really one of the strands of Alcoa's DNA. From the very first airplane that flew on the Wright Brothers Flyer, it was Alcoa that came up with an aluminum alloy for the engine block so the plane could actually fly. And we've been innovating in aerospace all the way to today. If you look at the latest generation of aircraft flying, the Boeing 787, the Airbus A350, carbon fiber structure, it was our fasteners business anticipating, before they even had the need, that there would be an electromagnetic management issue with these aircraft. Otherwise, colloquially said, lightning strike if it gets hit by lightning. It's our business that's always been on the cutting edge of fastening technology that developed a fastener that not only can bond a carbon fiber skin to a titanium structure underneath, handle the thermal expansion issues, galvanic corrosion issues, but actually attracts the current from a lightning strike and then dissipates it into a conductive medium underneath. We anticipated that need. We got out in front of it, invested our dollars into it, and created solutions for those companies that when the need hit, we were there ready to go, which has given us a leading position with a completely innovative brand new product that's got a huge amount of, and we'll talk about it later, advanced manufacturing to make those kind of products and bring it into market. So at the core of what we do is continuously pushing the envelope of reducing our cost structure or bringing new innovative products to market. And as long as we do that, we can stay globally competitive in a very challenging world.
Actually, that is very interesting to hear about the innovation, both on the process side as well as the product side. So, Tony, you know, people don't always think of Pfizer as a manufacturing company, but yet I know one-third of your employees work in the manufacturing sector. So from your perspective, how have drug therapies changed, and how has this affected manufacturing?
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to thank you. Thank you for having me here. Second of all, I want to come to your plants because you know, I'm into manufacturing. It sounds really interesting. And thank you for aluminum frames. I have a nice Audi that has an aluminum frame, and
fantastic.
It was nice and
we
light.
We designed the 88 frame.
And thank you, Johnny, for sponsoring. This is a great opportunity for me. I think that when people think of pharmaceutical companies, they don't generally think about manufacturing. They think about the end product and what it does. And that's very important because, obviously, we're an innovation-based company. I mean, Pfizer... The basic innovation and research is about $8 billion of our a year, about 14% of our revenue. But for manufacturing, let me just say we call ourselves Pfizer Global Supply because right now, in the manufacturing space and what we do, we have an internal, external, globally integrated network. We have about 56 plants around the world now. It's gone up and down through all the mergers we've done. And in our plants, we'll talk a little bit about it, but very sophisticated. Things have changed over the years. So you can see from my resume that I've been with Pfizer for a while. Like I said, it started when I was 10 years old in Brooklyn. That's my side story. And what's happened to therapies? So we have about right now, we supply Pfizer across all the consumer business, pharmaceutical business, about 21,000 SKUs, which are the presentations you get. Where the pharmacist gets. And it's very complex, and we supply to about 175 countries. I would say up until about maybe 10 years ago, you basically looked at handling chronic disease and the basic API or the active pharmaceutical ingredient was a chemical synthesis. So Pfizer came out, it was a chemical company back, we're over 160 years old, sorry, a little older than alcohol. It was a chemical company and a confectioner that got together, and that's how they kind of, Charles Pfizer and his cousin, and that's what they put together. So we kind of came out of that business. So what would happen in research is, in the innovation side, is they'd come up with a compound, and they'd look for a therapeutic effect, and it's almost like shots on goal. They'd see what the therapeutic effect is, but, five out of about 10,000 of those compounds actually made it into humans, and of those five, probably one became a product. So it's a very risky, innovative business, and it costs about... I'd say right now it costs about $1.3 billion to bring a product to market from beginning to end, and there's lots of failures along the way. I just read about one this morning that was, I get the news, Roche had a failure in one of their diabetes products, and a lot of disappointments. That's all sunk costs. But the bottom line is innovation is the driver. So what's happened to the products now, you hear about biologicals, so bios. The small molecule products are chemical synthesis products. So, they're basically looking at something that we can do in a laboratory and then put it into a chemical plant. Where the bios are more natural products, and we differentiate them by small molecule. You'll hear this said in large molecule. And if I had a picture, you'd see a little car and a big 747. I mean that's like the difference between the size of the molecules under a microscope in terms of relative size. And the biologicals basically are very complex processes. So if you walked into one of our biological plants, you'd be amazed, what you see. It's the upstream process and the downstream process, but a lot of separation technologies that are very, very sophisticated, very expensive. And generally speaking, in the large molecule world, you design a process and a plant for the product. So it adds to the risk factor because if you don't make it multiple product, you've got a plant that you're kind of stuck with. On the small molecule side, now here's what's happening in Pfizer, and I'm really excited. There's one drug that we have right now that has breakthrough therapy with sort of classification with FDA, so that means we could advance it through the pipeline pretty quick. And that's a drug called palbociclib, and it's for HER2-negative breast cancer. Now, that's personally meaningful for me for personal reasons, but that particular drug is a small molecule. And it was discovered because now there's a much greater knowledge in deep biology. So now we're applying deep biology and more precision medicine to the small molecule field. So what's happened as a result of that, these compounds are much more potent, and you need less of them. So Lipitor was the biggest product in the world. You make tons and tons of atorvastatin, which was the active for Lipitor. And, you know, that just went off patent recently. And it was for chronic disease. The new therapies are more precision medicine and, you know, targeted towards certain gene type, targeted towards certain, you know, populations, you know, whatever the target is. And they're generally very high potency compounds, so you make less of them. So we've shifted from, on our API side, to sort of like, not really chemical plants, but large vessel plants to real smaller focus plants. On the other side, on the biologicals, it's a whole new different area because the education of the workforce is different. I mean, when you go through those plants, most of the operators are, you know, degreed persons, and they really need to know what they're doing. And there's automation throughout all the plants, but you really need people that can, you know, work through the process. Also, what hasn't changed over the years, and it's actually gotten a lot tighter, we're probably one of the most, if not the most, regulated business in the industry. So it's with FDA and with all the different inspections agencies around the world. So we're around the world, and what we're finding is that even in the emerging markets, the regulatory agencies are getting more sophisticated. So there isn't a day that goes by that we're not being inspected somewhere in the world. So what we do is very, very buttoned up, I guess you'd say, in terms of, you know, what our processes are. And from the standpoint of how we do it, how we dress, you know, how the facilities are designed. If you came into one of our plants, I think, you know, you'd be surprised at what you see. But I've been really pleased to be in this industry all my life, just about, because we're in the well-being industry. My personal, my personal purpose in life is to, you know, persistently make a positive difference. So I feel good when I go to work even on Mondays, sometimes. I feel really motivated. So when we get a breakthrough therapy like palbociclib, and others, and it's what really motivates me. It's what motivates our workforce. So you can go to any one of our plants, and that's what excites us. And really the caring, even on the shop floor, for what they do. They're not just putting bottles in boxes. They understand what they're really working on. So it's an industry that makes a difference. I think it's an important industry. And we can get into why, you know, what we need to do to protect it and keep it in the United States also.
That's exactly what I want to get into now. So okay. Clearly each of your companies are innovating in different sorts of ways, but I'm sure there are various barriers to doing better. And these barriers could be tax policy, regulatory issues, energy I know is a big issue in the manufacturing sector. So, Eric, I'll start with you. What are the biggest barriers that you're facing?
Yeah. Boy, we only have an hour. Well, let me just briefly touch on two, and I think that'll trigger quite a bit of discussion. At the end of the day, manufacturing has several inputs, from the material you use, the labor that is involved, the energy, the underlying processes, and then the regulatory and tax environment you function in. For a company, and particularly a manufacturing company, to be successful in the United States, you have to be globally competitive. Which means each one of these elements, when they get added up in their entirety, means that you need to be able to make a product that's either lower cost or better than what could be sourced somewhere else in the world. And for us, since we tend to have a good chunk of our business in less differentiated, like commodity products, you can buy aluminum or alumina on the London Metals Exchange. And then we also have very differentiated products, but through the manufacturing, we absolutely have to be competitive. Two that are things that the United States needs to get its hands around very, very forcefully and hopefully sooner rather than later. Number one, energy. We have to have competitive energy costs, whether that's natural gas, and there have been some benefits there. In fact, given the Marcellus Utica shale boom, we were actually able to reopen a refinery in Point Comfort, Texas. That we've actually had to shut down due to high energy costs. Now it's the third lowest cost facility in our operations, and that's a really nice benefit. But on the flip side, volatility and then higher prices in electricity, particularly where we see manufacturing in the more central parts of the country, as capacity's coming out of the market for a lot of different reasons, some of them driven by regulation. You don't see new capacity coming in, and then new charges associated with it. Electricity is a very major component of what we do, and as those costs continue to rise, and also there's increasing uncertainty around them, it really puts manufacturing at risk. The second one is going to be the labor pool, and the two items I would highlight on this one. Number one, linked to STEM education. Actually, what we really would like, and we were talking earlier about the model in Germany, is trade and vocational school training. You don't need a four-year degree to work in our plants. Over 80% of the people that work in Alcoa work in our production environments. Having a two-year degree to be a tradesperson, being a mechanic, an electrician, knowing how to run a CNC machine, knowing how to do basic programming on a PLC, that is the kind of skill set that we need in our facilities, and we have a very difficult time finding qualified folks to do that in many of our locations. Not all of them. There are some locations where we do it, but that's a systemic problem that we've got. Now, the other problem, and this one is much more basic and underlying, is finding folks that actually qualify at a basic level to work in our facility. And here, two things are, number one, pass a drug test. The number of applicants we get that don't even pass the basic drug test, it varies by location, is staggeringly high. And then number two, just a basic math proficiency at the high school level. So even before you get into two-year degree type of a programs, if we can crack the code on that, we have literally hundreds to thousands of positions in the U.S. that could be filled that we have a real challenge with just cracking the code on those issues.
Tony, what are the big barriers you see?
Well, you're going to be amazed when I tell you that, you know, your industry and our industry are no different in terms of what we do. So we have to be a globally competitive supply network, absolutely, especially when we get into emerging markets. Pfizer's business is somewhat bifurcated from the standpoint of there's the innovative side, but we would call it, I guess, sort of the value side. So a lot of our products are now generic. So we have to compete in that space also, and that competes more on cost. And I guess I have to make the point because it's very important. What we offer for Pfizer, so we're a critical element of Pfizer's success in the supply. Obviously, they have to, as the CFO says, you don't have any product, you don't make any money. But we call our fundamental value proposition, which is quality and compliance, supply and cost. But for us, we absolutely cannot, and I'm sure it's true for you too, we can't compromise on quality and compliance. So as we balance that triangle, especially the type of industry we're in, very difficult. So I'm not going to get into product shortages and all that kind of thing. But the bottom line is we're in this business that's very, very volume-based and generic-based, and we're in the innovative side. Now, obviously, the innovative side is what drives Pfizer's success in the future. So one of the biggest issues I think that we have on that side is intellectual property protection. So we need laws that are solid and basically laws that are reinforced globally, which is not happening. You know, we won't get into specifics, but there's not everybody honors IP. And that's a problem for us because, you know, what did I say before? 1.3 billion? You know, we've had some big failures. There was a follow-on to Lipitor, which was called Torcetrabib. We invested $1 billion in that drug, and it basically didn't make it. Robert's in the room. He worked in marketing. We had inhaled insulin. Inhaled insulin, it was a technical success, innovation, but a commercial failure, I guess. We still have to understand that, right? We wrote off $2.3 billion. You know, we have plants that we build that, you know, because we have to build them early in the process. So intellectual property and, you know, is basically the protection of that is, when we make that investment, we need to know that there's going to be sort of an income stream that's going to pay for that investment, because people always complain about the cost of their drugs. Well, you know, what you're really paying for is the innovation. Nobody wants to pay for that. You go around the world and you look at health systems. It's not the government that's doing research. I mean, we have 32 research centers around the world, 22 of them in this country. And the way we're doing research now is different than we used to do it. But that's the lifeblood of the company. The other piece is the same thing. It's an educated workforce. You know, when you go into our factories, certainly the biologicals, but all of them, they're all automated. I mean, it's most of our, I'd say half of our people have high school degrees. 15% of our people have postgraduate degrees. So there's a very technical aspect to producing pharmaceuticals. You know, it's and obviously not the control standpoint, but it's very, you know, there's very much process oriented and how we follow the processes. And how we understand them. So from the standpoint of workforce, I think what I just said to you is that our business is no different than your business. And the intellectual property, I'm sure, is important to you. Maybe we'll get into tax at some point, but tax is another issue.
Okay. Let's move to the audience participation part of this. So if you have a question, raise your hand. There's a gentleman right here. We have somebody with a microphone who's coming up from behind you. If you can give us your name and your organization, please.
John Haynes, and I'm an economic development consultant. And my question is, I think most young people and probably quite a few parents are totally unaware of the opportunities for people with technical capability, including people like welders who can weld in an environment that is clean at the end of the job and so forth. So the corollary to that would be that it's pretty hard to get people motivated to prepare for those careers that they don't know about and their parents don't know about. So what I'm wondering is if any of the panelists have any thoughts about this. And I would also mention that without a big manufacturing visibility, you know, even I had one mayor say recently that even though she knew a lot about the city, that she was surprised at how large their manufacturing workforce was, because again, there are no big plants in that city, the stuff that people are doing in their garages. So how would you inform people so that some of this STEM education would they be more motivated at the age that they're exposed to it?
Can I just want to make a comment, because I was going to say it before I thought about it when you said, and I could even relate it, you know, personally to my son. So I think, and, you know, in this country, there's a lot of young, educated people here. The goal seems to be everybody wants to go to college. You know, how can you compete? They have better SAT scores. And, you know, you go to college, you get a BS degree, and you say, well, that's not even enough anymore. You have to get an MBA or an advanced degree. You get out, and don't take this wrong, but a lot of people that I know get out of school, and they're working in the shopping mall because, you know, there's just no jobs from the standpoint of, you know, what they're doing. There's been, a little bit of a stigma around, you know, because of what people perceive as, to your point, what manufacturing is, those dirty welding jobs or whatever they are. Just not the, you know, not the kind of job that you think you want. You want to go get an education. You see what's going on, especially in the financial industry, the consulting industry, all those things. To me, manufacturing, you know, generates wealth. I mean, you're taking something and making it into something. You're generating. It's the basic, you know, basis of the economy. So for my son, I remember, you know, he used to follow me around when I worked in plants. And he loved it when I worked in plants. When I came to New York, we had to take your kid to work day when he was 16. So I took him to the office, and basically he spent all day. And at the end of the day, I said, James, so what did you learn today? And he said, well, it's that. He said, you know, I used to love it when I came to work with you in the plants. You know, it was great. I came here, and all you do is have meetings and talk on the phone. He said, that's not for me. So he went out and got a heating, air conditioning, and electrical degree, and that's what he does. And, you know, when you say that, it's like, and I'll just tell you personally, it's like, so my daughter's a teacher. She went to, you know, university, and he went to the technical degree. When you say that, it's almost like when I say it to people, it's like, oh, well, that's okay. It's like, you know, it's so there's a thing in this country about, you know, technical people and technical degrees versus college degrees. I know, you know, I would, you know, certainly the STEM, you know, is all around. So, you know, National Association of Manufacturers is really, really big on it with the, you know, with the Institute, basically looking at how do we educate the workforce. There's a good question, though. How do you get it early on? I think you have to start early on and often to sort of educate parents about this. I mean, you know, maybe it's going to happen naturally because of what I just said. You know, you're investing all this money in college degrees and people aren't getting jobs. That's going to be a little bit of a driver, but there's no attractiveness in it. You know, I don't know how many of you have been in manufacturing plants, but I think you'd be surprised if you haven't been in one to what you see. It's not the factory or the mayor, you know, looking for the smokestack, you know, in the city saying, gee, I don't know what's going on. You know, we have laboratories in New York City doing research. You wouldn't know that, okay? You know, but they're on, you know, the top floor of a building doing research, and they're highly technical. You know, and we have, you know, we have a manufacturing plant in Brooklyn that we sold, and it's converted over to small manufacturing, doing highly technical manufacturing. So you wouldn't see what you saw before. But you know, it really is the key is how do you get, you know, the young people interested?
Okay, Eric.
Yeah, I agree with your comments completely. Manufacturing today is very different than what you see in movies, on TV, and the manufacturing of decades ago. To the specific question, though, about how do you influence and communicate to younger folks, I'd say there's a bottom-up issue and a top-down issue. Just speaking for ourselves, we have locations all around the world and all around the country, just about every part of the country. What we have done historically as Alcoa is we work in our communities. We find universities nearby for undergraduate, graduate, postgraduate degrees. We have a plant in Lafayette, Indiana. We work with Purdue. Cleveland, Ohio, we're working with Case Western. And we have those kind of relationships around the country. But at the same time we have that, we also partner with community colleges and trade schools in the area so that they are training folks on the skills we need, whether it's programming PLCs, running CNCs, doing welding, electricians, maintenance work, with our formal apprenticeship programs through those as well. So we will do that in sort of a local or regional basis. And you see these little hubs forming around the country near where our facilities are. And actually, I think it's too naive or short-sighted to say that that's an issue for the country. Because there are parts of the country where people actually want to go into manufacturing. If you're in South Carolina, you're in Alabama, you're in parts of Texas, you're in parts of Arizona around Phoenix, you're in Southern California, and going into high-tech manufacturing jobs is actually quite an attractive proposition. There's other places where it's not. So that's a different perception issue that does require a top-down or a little bit more work to try to address. And building on what we heard here earlier, I do think we have a systemic flaw in our expectations in this country that the road to success is a 4-year degree. Because statistically, there are more, you could argue, higher paying jobs out there. I mean, if you are a qualified welder right now and you are willing to locate to where either a manufacturing facility is or where oil and gas exploration is, you're talking nice 3-digit salaries coming out of a 2-year school. And there are plenty of people with undergraduate degrees. It'll take a long time before they're making that. And so there's got to be a little bit of a change in the communication at our high school level and all the way down to, you know, how our guidance counselors, student aid gets distributed. If there was as much opportunity or communication around getting a 2-year degree as a 4-year degree coming out of a guidance school, and also maybe changing some of the incentives on student loans so that there was a little bit more pressure that you actually get a degree in a job in a field that will employ you, and you actually graduate instead of going into a 4-year program to just get in so that the money gets dispersed, but then people don't even graduate. And that's something that I really wish we would take on. But to put in a real plug for this, manufacturing is absolutely key to the GDP growth of the United States, because for the most part, you can't export a service. What you export are products, you know, drugs, medical devices, aluminum, cars, whatever it is, that drives GDP growth. You want a case study? Look at Germany. They get there by exporting products. If we ever think we're going to grow the U.S. by being a service economy, that's way too short-sighted. Secondly, R&D dollars. 65% of all of the R&D dollars spent in the United States are spent in fields associated with manufacturing that ultimately lead to a product that you can hold in your hand, ingest, or use. 90% of all the patents out there are related to manufacturing. And so if we lose sight of that in how we communicate to our children in secondary school education and then into vocational or 2-year schools or 4-year, we're really selling ourselves short, because we're selling ourselves something that's not true.
Okay, other questions? Bob.
Eric, you mentioned drug testing. And if we are, in fact, moving towards de facto legalization of marijuana, if we are, in fact, moving towards that, how do manufacturers cope with that?
Well, I wouldn't single out marijuana over any other thing. I mean, we have as much of an issue with alcohol abuse as we would with any other illicit drug. It's just another thing that's out there. It in no way lessens the requirements we have and the processes we go through when we're hiring new people or as we, you know, police our facilities today if there's an incident or other things on a regular program. I think what it does, though, is it expands the cultural acceptance of the use of these kind of materials. So people, if you think, well, now it's no longer illicit, shouldn't I be allowed to have used it a certain period of time before I come to the job? Well, no. Manufacturing is manufacturing. It's in the physical world. You are around equipment, whether it's highly automated automation and robotics to forklifts to overhead cranes, and you have to have your wits about you. Look what happens when you don't have your wits about you and you take your eye off task just a little while. Bad things can happen, whether you're driving on the highway or whether you're in a manufacturing environment. So we need to work as a society and as employers out there to do all we can to educate, communicate, but also ensure compliance to these rules and regulations.
Well, I make a different comment, but the same sort of the same vein. So we have impairment. It's all about impairment. So we have impairment policies. So, you know, it happens now, whether it's legal or illegal. You know, you have people coming in under influence of something. We do drug testing in some places. Some places we can't do it. So it doesn't really matter, you know, what happens. So we look for impairment to the point where, so our supervisors are trained, you know, to look for that. Our coworkers, there's a lot of discussion because safety is a very important part of what we do. And that's a buddy system kind of thing. So if your coworker, and you'll see this in plants, you know, is not performing, generally speaking, you're going to hear about it. And then, you know, then that's how you get into it. So even if it's legalized, if you come in impaired, I mean, I get to work very early in New York, and I'm walking down the street, and not that I know what marijuana smells like, but the bottom line is it's on the sidewalk at 6 o'clock in the morning. These guys are construction workers going in. You know, who knows what they're doing? You know, they're probably putting in HVAC systems, you know, in buildings. Right? They have all the aluminum they're bringing up. So it's about impairment. So even if it's legalized, you know, alcohol is legal. So it's about, you know, how people show up to work.
Over here, we have a question.
Diana Negroponte, the Brookings Institution. Salary is the main impetus, and between choosing between a desk job and a machine job. Would each of you please tell us what the comparative salaries are for an accountant as opposed to a welder or someone working on the machine?
I could talk to the United States. So our average operator in a plant is just an operator working on a machine. It's somewhere with benefits, probably the $60,000 to $80,000 a year range, and probably they're relatively high paying jobs. Now, I don't know the salary of an incoming accountant, but I think it's lower than that. But what you have to look at. So I was going to make this point before. So you can come into a plant as a worker. All right, and you can come into a company as an accountant. The trajectory of your career is largely dependent on you. So we have the opportunity in both ends. So a lot of our supervisors and managers basically came out of the operator ranks. So they've either started out, you know, in manufacturing, running a machine. Maybe they have a technical degree. Maybe they have a 2-year degree. They'll go get some, you know, some degree. You know, we'll pay for that in the educational assistance program. And I can name several people, you know, a lot of them, you know, certainly in our group that came that way. One of our plant manager in Lincoln, Nebraska, started out on the floor, and he got an accounting degree, became a finance person, got through finance, went back into manufacturing, learned more about manufacturing from the management side, and became a plant manager, a very successful career. So, to me, it's more individual related than it is, you know, the actual job you come in on.
Yeah, I agree with that exactly, and the numbers are very consistent. The two things I might add are that the more skilled your trade, if you know how to be in the quality world, for example, to be a level 2 inspector, be a level 3 inspector, you're writing your own ticket, and your career is fantastic. And you can get there by going through a 2-year degree program and then taking supplemental training. If you are willing to be mobile, and you're a welder or an electrician or a maintenance person, the sky's the limit, particularly if you're willing to work overtime. And you're going to have indexed wage growth potential that's significantly better than an office job. But at the end of the day, supply-demand works in the labor force as it works elsewhere. And right now, the supply-demand imbalance is an overabundance of people that want white-collar jobs and an underabundance of people that are willing to, you know, roll their sleeves up a little bit and get out there on the shop floor. And money goes to where supply and demand is telling it to go.
Okay, there's a woman right here who has her hand up close to it. Yes. Yeah, we have a microphone coming over to you.
My name is Claudia Farris. I'm with George Mason University, PhD candidate. You mentioned, what did you call it, deep biology.
Right.
And my sense is that one of the things that's driving deep biology is an understanding of how interactions occur at that level. My dissertation is in the application of complexity science, but it's to the social systems. And I want to suggest to you that deep biology, the concepts behind deep biology, apply equally well to social interactions.
Absolutely.
Example, I did my undergraduate degree in physics. Why? Because my mother folded towels in a particular way. And when she explained to me how to get those towels folded right, she explained it in terms of the relationship between the edges and yada yada, how to get them perfect. She wasn't a scientist. She just thought it was beautiful in the way they looked in the closets. Same deal with cooking. Why you have to do things in a certain order. You can't put the baking soda or the baking powder in while you're mixing the eggs and oil. You know, you have that kind of thing. I want to ask you if you're paying it in terms of building a workforce, there's a certain kind of structural thinking that goes into a technical ability, right? And it doesn't start in high school. It starts in when you're at your mother's, you know, what a kind of thing. Are you paying attention to the changes in our society at that level, which have an impact on the way people's thinking evolves?
Yeah, so first of all, I'd say I made brownies once and forgot to put the eggs in until they were in the oven. Yeah, I'm a pretty good cook, but I'm not very good at making brownies.
Hockey pucks.
Exactly. They're really pretty finished, though. I mean, it's really interesting. You know, that's an interesting observation because I could speak personally. So for some reason, when I whatever happened to me growing up is I seem to be I'm a chemical engineer by training, and I knew I wanted to do that. I'm just probably dumb, you know. Early on, I played my chemistry set, but I've always been process oriented. You know, so I'm a process thinker. You have different kinds of thinkers in the world. I mean, there's process thinkers that are more linear engineers, and you have more, you know, the holistic kind of thinking. I don't know how you get the education down, or how do you, you know, make that aware? How can you make somebody that's not a process thinker become a process thinker? I left brain, right brain. I mean, I don't know how that happens. Not everybody is probably even, you know, suited to do, you know, engineering or whatever, you know, math, science, but more of the liberal arts. So, you know, with your, you know, education and what you're doing, you know, that's a problem. You know, it would be interesting to see your insights. But I have no idea how to answer that question.
Okay, can I chime in with a thought that's a slightly different look on that? At the end of the day, we are all blessed to be in this country. And those of us that have jobs and that can create employment and that are anchors in our communities have an associated responsibility. And some of us take it very seriously. And one of the things that we've been very blessed with in Alcoa is an incredible heart of our folks at all levels for service. You know, we have our Alcoa Foundation that gives big grants, but our people contribute. And so we as Alcoa aren't going to solve a nationwide systemic issue, but what we can do is we can draw a little ring around our facilities and where our employees work every day and get involved. One of the areas that every one of our facilities does get involved with in service is education. And we actually go all the way down to K through 12 with charter schools and with schools in inner city. I mean, my office is in Cleveland, our plant. We have a plant there that's in the inner city of Cleveland. And we partner with K through 12 schools that are struggling, and our people will go and spend huge amounts of time tutoring and contributing and volunteering, and it builds a little bit of a personal bond that then you watch these folks through. We have local scholarships that then will take folks in their, you know, sophomore, junior, senior year and try to get them in early to then get them into a community college, etc. So it's a little thing, but if we step up to those responsibilities and lead in service in our communities the same way we lead in innovation in our products or processes, that's one step in the right direction that if enough people do it, it starts to close a little bit of the gap.
Yeah, I do have an added comment to that because you just reminded me or ticked the thought off. So in our plants, I talked before about people rising and, you know, and doing different things. What we found is, you know, I was plant manager for a number of years. If it came to my desk, it was too late. And I can't solve the problem. It has to be solved on the shop floor. So this process thinking, even though people come in as operators, whether they have it or not, you know, maybe they just got a job. For what we do, and we have a lot of Six Sigma training going on throughout all of our facilities. So we have yellow belts, green belts, black belts. And by the way, those people are worth their weight in gold. And, you know, some of them we lose because once we train them, even if they're not four-year degree people, they pretty much are in demand. So they kind of develop that. But they have the answers. There's several problems I tried to solve once, and we were big into continuous improvement. And all it was one problem, I remember, in a Puerto Rico plant where we thought it was pretty simple. You know, the scientists, and the operator said, no, he said, there's something wrong with this filter. You know, it's not filtering. It goes and it stops. And we found out they had the wrong material in it. But, you know, and just, you know, the understanding and saying, okay, I know how this works. And so that develops, you know, once they come in. So to answer the question, how do you get them interested, I'm not sure how to answer that. But I know once they get in, basically, we involve everybody, you know, in our operation. You can't run an operation without involving everybody. Every job's important.
There's a person right there, a woman with her hand up, if you can get the microphone to her. Yep.
Hi, Heidi Shepherd with NIST Manufacturing Extension Partnership. I have a question going back to the innovation aspect of what your companies do. How do you think that small and medium-sized manufacturers could possibly learn from your innovation models or benefit from what you do? Perhaps your suppliers are somehow integrated in your innovation practices, or I'm looking out for the small and medium-sized manufacturers. I'm wondering if you have any words of wisdom on that. Thanks.
Well, I'll start off with that. Oddly enough, for being a very large company, we're composed of very many individuals. And innovation very rarely occurs in groupthink. Innovation oftentimes is sparked by one or two people getting together and having an idea and then figuring out how to bring it to market. Building on that, we as an organization exist in supply chains. Think about that old BASF ad, we don't make the products you make, we make them better. Alcoa advancing each generation, we end up working in the transportation chain, in packaging chain, consumer electronics chain. We work very closely with our customers, and we work with our suppliers. And at any moment in time, there are always challenges we're trying to solve. Some we take on ourselves, and some we look for partners. Oftentimes, you know, innovative small partners. I'll give you an example right now. There is an emergent trend that you see and read about in the press called additive manufacturing. We as Alcoa have actually been in additive manufacturing for over a decade. It's been core to our process in making investment castings. Those are the blades and vanes for airfoils. From molds and dyes and things we do, we actually additive manufacture on surface features and coatings. But it's expanding into the material set that you can use, and it's expanding into the types of applications to final end products. There is no physical way right now we can cover every potential avenue. You do EB, do you vapor deposition, all the different ways you can do it. And there's so many different technologies out there. So we actually look to find other companies and other small partners that we can start to look at, partner with, potentially invest in, potentially buy. And so linking in with a big company like ourselves or with our customers to solve a problem means the ecosystem actually will thrive when you get cooperation amongst many different sized players. Just big guys alone or just small guys alone will have a harder time than if you can get an ecosystem working together where you can get a lot of metabolic energy out there and then right answers will emerge that much more quickly.
I'm going to make a comment from two points on this. First of all, Pfizer itself. If you looked at Pfizer a few years ago, you'd see big research centers, one in Sandwich, one in Groton, a few others around the world. It got so big that, you know, it was too big. I mean, so the interaction you're talking about wasn't happening. We've almost gone to a completely different model, more akin to small and medium manufacturers. So we learn from the small biotechs that it might be great to have 50 scientists, you put them in a building somewhere, let them go. You know, or 25 scientists, you let them go. Not these big centers that have all the development, everything staged on each floor. And I'd say that the small and medium manufacturers probably are, you know, they're just as innovative and have just as big a chance. So certainly in my involvement with NAM, you know, you see them all. It's been a big education for me, 12,000 members across, you know, mostly small and medium manufacturers. And I sit and talk with, you know, the folks there, you know, when I go to the meetings, and I'm amazed by some of the things they're doing. They're advancing in metals, and, you know, in fields that I'm not involved in. But the model almost is better in the small, and I think the big companies are actually going towards the small and the collaboration. So we have CTI, so Center for Therapeutic Innovation, all over the country. People are clamoring to get into these things. That's on a university base, but also, you know, there's small segmented, you know, segmented groups. I just think that I don't see a differentiation. I guess I see a learning from the standpoint of, you know, from the small companies.
There's a person back there.
My name's Jim Jordan. I work in been in the Navy most of my life, but I've worked in manufacturing a lot. Are you guys having problems with paying a livable wage in the United States that sort of moves you to expand outside the United States? That's sort of interest me. Both companies, I'd like both of you to address it. Thank you.
There we go. Okay, so what we're finding is that we operate globally, so all over the world, you know, we tend to, even in different markets, our jobs are, you know, a little more higher paying in some cases, but we look for the market and what's there. And I would say that global competition on wages is starting to equalize. It doesn't seem to be the driving factor. So we do what he mentioned plant network strategy. So, we've ended up, because of mergers and acquisitions, having over 100 plants going up, going down. We had 30,000 employees. Now we have 22,000. You know, we've done that a couple of times over the last 10 years. And we look at, you know, wages is certainly one of the factors, but it's never the determining factor as, you know, where a factory should be. It's not as big a piece of the pie. It's, you know, it's our biggest piece probably is, you know, where we locate is I guess, having the skilled and educated workforce, certainly in the bio side, and you pay for that. But I don't know about you guys, but, you know, the wages differentiation.
Yeah. I mean, first off, Jim, I'd like to say thank you for your service. A career in the Navy is something to be very proud of. Thank you for that. As we look at, and I think completely echoing your comments, when we decide to open a facility outside of the United States, the two overriding reasons why we do that are, number one, market access. We have the largest rolling mill in Russia making can stock, because that's where you need to be to tell can stock to the Russians for their aluminum cans. That's why we put that plant there. Number two is for an advantaged position in one of those inputs we talked about. But in our business, that tends to be low-cost energy or a low-cost material source. We have bauxite mines in Australia as opposed to the U.S. because it's a really good bauxite and it's really low cost and it's very close to China, who's going to use it. Or in energy, we're involved in the largest integrated aluminum complex on Earth right now in Saudi Arabia because of the access to stranded natural gas, which can drive power plants in the production of the aluminum. Labor is an element, but has not been the driving reason why we've put a facility outside of the U.S., in my memory.
Well, I mean, it's probably not making enough stuff and having it to export. I mean, so it's demand for our products from the standpoint of, okay, Pfizer pharmaceutical products are a little bit different. I mean, you know, just one of these things that, you know, even if you don't have the money, it's kind of difficult not to get your pharmaceutical, and how it gets paid for and all that is a different story. But, you know, I live in South Carolina part-time, too, so the issue about South Carolina and Boeing and everybody there, I mean, it became demand. I mean, that Boeing plant was put there for a reason. It basically was, all of a sudden, you know, you have the 787, I think it's being assembled there, and there was demand and there was a need. So the basic need for products is what I think is the basic demand, and the whole economy itself is what's driving the unemployment. It's related. This other issue that compounds, you know, people out of the workforce and all of a sudden you can't get them back in. Nobody brought this up, but I know for a fact, I won't mention the company, but it's a small boat company that makes nice fishing boats. And my wife spent an afternoon there with the owner of the company, who had 25-year employees that they had to lay off in 2008. They wanted to hire them back. They said, no, we're not coming back. We're making more on unemployment. Yeah. So why do we want to go to work?
Okay, we have time for one last question. If we can make this a quick question, then we'll move to our next panel.
Focusing on American manufacturing and considering the obstacles that you identify to your continued growth and success, how does the immigration debate factor into those concerns?
Well, I mean, it's important, I think, because certainly on the educated side, people come to this country, get educated, and then leave. So what are they doing? We're educating our competitors. I mean, I think you're much. This is my personal view, and I think it's also the view in the company. If we train, educate, work with people in this country, there's a brain power that needs to stay here, and I think I'm very much in favor of from that standpoint.
You know, I think I can answer your question and that question in the same way. And that is, we will be successful manufacturing in North America when we are globally competitive, which means we can make a product at a lower cost or that's more differentiated than the alternatives.
At high quality, of course.
At very high quality, delivered on time. And then we will succeed. Yeah. And when it comes to labor, you need to have skilled labor, whether it's advanced degrees and you don't want them to go to work with our competitors, or out on the shop floor, wherever that is. And anything we can do to promote bringing skilled labor into the workforce, we want to do. And then similarly, and I'm going to echo a comment that's over here, we can't answer unemployment in the United States. But what I can tell you is, if you want to have a globally competitive manufacturing capability, it needs to be more attractive for someone to want to actually work in that environment than to not work in that environment. And as long as we maintain situations where it's more attractive to not work than work, people, on average, won't work.
I mean, one quick comment, it's very personal. But so from the standpoint of automobiles, so I was in Germany, and I'm a big Audi fan, so I have some Audis, and I went there, and I saw some factories. They're great. But I got to tell you that tonight, when I go home, I'm trading in my Mini, which is a BMW, for a Ford. So you say, why am I doing that? Well, because the product got better. And so the product's innovative, and the product got better. So the innovation, and that's going to drive demand, in this economy also. And probably the Ford, the parts are made all over, but I'm buying a Ford and not a foreign car.
That's progress right there. So we're out of time on this session, but I want to thank Tony and Eric for sharing their views, and then we'll invite our next panelist to come up here.
Great. Great job. How do we take this off?
Start with you, and then we'll go to options. Take it to you with this employment question. Would that be a good way to start your remarks? So what's the? Do you have a preferred question to start off?
Intelligently, the unemployment question. It's not the
unemployment question. Well, thank you all. Welcome to the second panel. We're going to have a lot of fun, and I have a great couple of folks. It's a very different panel than your last one. I like to think we're going to be a little wonkier, which in my world is a really good thing. And that we're going to be a little more analytical about the broad macro experience than just sort of the micro, which was fascinating. So think of this as you're pulling back the camera. My name is Jim Tankersley. I cover economics for the Washington Post. With me are two really, really smart people. Mark Levinson's a manager of transportation industry analysis for the Congressional Research Service, which writes all sorts of reports which are fantastically helpful in my job. And Asha Balakrishnan is a research staff member for the IDA Science and Technology Policy Institute. We're just going to jump in right away. Our panel is talking about, is manufacturing the key to recapturing America's edge? And we're going to think about that question in two ways. First off, a broad economics competitiveness question, but also in terms of the edge for the American worker, those 12 million unemployed people we were talking about in the last panel, and the overall workforce that is looking to get ahead in the years to come. So I want to start with Mark. Can we talk about that? Workforce manufacturing was for so long this great driver of American jobs and prosperity that hasn't as much been the case. We had a little bit of an uptick in the recovery, but we've had a bad few months of job losses again in manufacturing. What's the state of play with jobs and the future of manufacturing?
Well, it's an important point, Jim. The interest that people have in manufacturing stems in part from the association of manufacturing and employment. And most of us of a certain age remember the days when a large proportion of the workforce was employed in manufacturing. It's just not that way now. The statistics, and you probably know them, we've seen since the trough of the recession roughly a 20% increase in U.S. industrial production, and that's gone hand in hand with a 2% increase in manufacturing employment. So when you ask the question, how is manufacturing doing, the answer depends on whom you're thinking about. There are a couple of things that I would point out that are important to recognize when you're talking about this subject. One is that U.S. manufacturing is now extremely capital-intensive. That wasn't raised explicitly in the previous panel, but both of the gentlemen who are on the previous panel work in industries where you have a large amount of equipment and not a large number of people on the factory floor. And that's become the norm in this country. Just to give you an example, although it varies from year to year, the U.S. steel industry produces about as much now as it did 1980, 1981. The labor force has dropped by 75% since then. So you just don't need the workers on the factory floor the way you once did. And the connection between manufacturing and employment is much weaker than it used to be. A second thing that I'd point out is that much of the job loss we've experienced in manufacturing over the past couple of decades has been in industries that had pretty low productivity growth. Those are the industries that are essentially forced out by more open international markets. And those industries aren't coming back. Those are industries that tended to have pretty high employment, and we're not going to see those jobs again. Again, an example, you don't have to go back too many decades, and the apparel industry in this country employed 1.4 million people. They were running sewing machines in New York garment lofts and in Alabama cut and sew plants. We're down from 1.4 million people in this industry to about 140,000. Why? Well, because this is an industry that was and is extremely difficult to automate. There haven't been very effective ways to bring capital to bear in making shirts and trousers and things like that. And so it's an industry that migrated to places where wages were low. And there are several industries like that. Shoes are another example. Toy manufacturing is another example. Those industries used to employ a lot of Americans. They don't anymore, and we're not likely to see those jobs coming back. The third thing that is affecting the employment that's really quite significant here is we've seen vertical disintegration in manufacturing as in many other industries. What that means is that we don't have everything now under one roof. Many of the manufacturing companies we have, including those that were represented here, have gotten rid of what used to be a lot of their businesses, and they specialize in what they think they're good at. And that certainly depresses the number of manufacturing workers. You do have people out there who are employed in other sectors of the economy, be it transport or services or whatever, whose jobs are related to manufacturing, and they don't show up in the manufacturing statistics. So those are the three points I'd make. I think the bottom line here is that assuring prosperity and assuring continued growth in manufacturing output doesn't by itself do much in terms of employment.
So, Asha, let's pull back a little farther and just ask, why is this important? If manufacturing isn't necessarily going to put 12 million people back to work, can you give us sort of an overview of where we are in the sector and what it's adding to the economy and that recapturing its edge?
Sure. So what I would say is that while manufacturing jobs may be decreasing, and we've seen that decline, and as Mark pointed out, one of the things I'd like to also add to that is the sort of the vertical disintegration creates maybe an inaccuracy in some of the data and the way we capture employment statistics, because we're no longer capturing those people who are in the transport sector or the service sector as part of the manufacturing sector, but they are critical to keeping a vibrant manufacturing sector. So that's kind of one of my points that I'd like to make, is that I think we need to be perhaps thinking about, and I think people are doing this, in updating some of the data series that policymakers use very, very frequently to make policy decisions for a more globalized economy, because we're using data and the way we capture data from 30, 40, 50 years ago, but that's not the way manufacturing is happening today. It's very embedded with services. I'd say, in addition to that, research and development goes hand in hand with manufacturing, and I think there were some statistics quoted in the last session where something like 70% of business R&D investment is by manufacturing companies. The Burtis survey, which NSF reports on, basically states that 22% of companies in manufacturing industries reported at least one product or process innovation last year versus 8% of non-manufacturing companies. So innovation is happening at these manufacturing companies. And what we do also understand, and what we've seen and what we have stories about, is that if we don't continue to invest in and do R&D, then manufacturing is going to, in co-location with manufacturing, then we're not going to be able to get to that next innovation. And so one of the reasons that manufacturing has decreased is not only because things like apparel industries have moved offshore, but also because, quite frankly, we've gotten better at doing automation, and we've been able to take our productivity levels much higher by automating things. But that, what that's supposed to mean is there's supposed to be a spillover benefit of coming up with the newest robotics technology and the newer technologies. And if we don't do that here anymore, we're not going to be able to kind of harness that capability.
Is that circle completing right now? Are we seeing those spillovers that the theory would expect us to see?
I would say that manufacturing is still contributing quite a bit to the economy. I think as an industry, for every dollar invested, you have $1.35 that manufacturing sort of spills over into the economy. That might be fluctuating slightly, but I think it's still higher than any other industry. So I'm not sure the circle is completing. I think we still need to do a lot more to invest in R&D. Manufacturing companies need to invest in R&D, and I think that co-location is very important for that next product to be invented. One story that I'm stealing a little bit from Willie Shi and in some of the work that they've done at Harvard is this story of Kodak, where, you know, Kodak basically decided to kind of invest more in the film technology, and kind of kept the consumer digital camera technology on the side, They had a product and they had a technology that they were investing in, but when they started to see that this was something that could possibly take off, there were no longer the suppliers that did flat panel displays and microelectronics and the things that they needed to continue that business and to really build it up. So it was a labor force issue as well as a supplier base issue. And that had tended to move offshore. So they actually had to move some of their product development offshore as well. And so when that happens, you're not able to ride that next wave of innovation.
Thoughts on that relationship?
Yes, this issue of co-location is an interesting story. And I guess the question to be asked, for which I've not seen a satisfactory answer, is whether it's true. The assertion here, for those of you who aren't familiar with this debate, is that if you don't have the physical manufacturing, then the intellectual part of the exercise, the R&D, if you will go away, that these somehow need to be in proximity. And so you can't keep one without the other. That claim is made by a lot of people. The evidence for it is hard to find. You can certainly find examples of companies that had difficulty because they didn't have the manufacturing in proximity to their R&D. Then again, you can find plenty of U.S. companies that have done quite well, even though their R&D is in one place and they make things elsewhere, or they don't even make things at all. You've probably had this experience. You know, ask any 20-year-old to name a manufacturer, and that person will tell you Apple, right? Well, Apple owns one factory in the entire world, and it seems to have done okay in the innovation department, despite the fact that it doesn't have a plant next to its research center, or despite the fact that it doesn't actually own the plants that make its goods or employ the people who make its goods. So I think we see a lot of mixed stories here. And whether there's actually strong evidence that you need this physical proximity between R&D and manufacturing, to me the case is kind of open on that. I'm not convinced either way.
So one of the counters to that would be a human capital answer, correct? That if you have people who are engaged in manufacturing, who are high-skilled people who are figuring out shop floor innovations, that's just provides a human capital spillover for the rest of the economy. Those are people who, even if that plant closes or they move on, can go and be innovators in other spheres?
Well, it's partially a human capital story. It's also a problem-solving story, okay? I mean, the story essentially tends to be that you've got these people who invented some great product or process, but it doesn't exactly work as planned, and if the factory is next door, they can run over and get those problems solved and have everything operating. And if the factory isn't next door, then it's quite complicated and maybe their idea doesn't work out so well. That is essentially the argument here. And again, you see evidence of it working both ways in the real world. So the extent to which co-location is actually critical is not clear to me.
And does the idea of manufacturing being essential, and either of you jump in on this, to America's sort of continued competitiveness, does that depend on what the answer to the co-location question, or are there other reasons why it might be?
Do you want to start with that?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, is it just the idea that we need manufacturing because it helps with the R&D and that co-location is so critical for competitiveness, or are there other reasons why just making things is helpful to competitiveness?
So I would say, let's take the co-location issue to the side. I think one thing about that is that perhaps it's very anecdotal, but at the same time, I do believe, and this maybe is biased from my background, I'm a mechanical engineer by training, and I think that in order to invent things, you need to know how to make them and work with your hands and be able to actually do the work in order to come up with the next innovation. And so whether or not you're coming up with that next innovation here or somewhere else, I think that it's very important to know how to make things. So yes, I think innovation does happen in knowing how to make things and knowing how to, I think in the last session it was mentioned that we have a service economy that's been growing, but I do think it's on the heels of a manufacturing economy. And if you don't know how to create something and create a product and export something, your services are kind of tied to that.
Oh, let me respond in a somewhat different way to your question. The way people think about the role of manufacturing in the economy has changed somewhat, I think, over time. And this is because the nature of manufacturing has changed over time. You know, there aren't a lot of products anymore that are made in one place from start to finish. Okay? The manufacturing process now is really a process along what economists call a value chain, okay, where you have different parts of the process, perhaps done in different places, perhaps done in different countries. It gets very difficult to quantify in terms of understanding the economic impact. So you may have a product which was developed in a U.S. lab with input from R&D centers in Switzerland and Japan, and then pieces of the manufacturing will be farmed out, essentially. You'll have inputs from Japan and Korea and Mexico, and the product may be assembled in Vietnam or whatever. And it gets very hard to understand what is an American product in that sort of world. And so the way economists tend to think about this now is where the economic benefit comes is capturing as much of the value of that product, trying to have the value added domestically, which is not necessarily the same as what we think of as physical production. It's not necessarily where the product is stamped or where the metal is cut or where the bolts are screwed into the nuts or whatever. And so the distinction between manufacturing and non-manufacturing is somewhat blurred in this world, and the question of what is made where is very unclear.
All right, let's shift a little bit. I want to talk about policy, because long ago and far away, by which I mean like three election cycles ago, I covered politics in Ohio. And starting then, and basically in every election I've covered since, all you hear about from politicians who are trying to appeal to middle-class voters is the manufacturing is important, we're not doing enough to support it, and we need to do a better job. So, Ash, I want to sort of start with the question, are we doing the right things from a federal policy level to support manufacturing? And if not, what should we be doing?
So I'm going to go back to R&D.
Yeah.
A little bit. I think that, you know, there have been several reports written in several administrations over the past 10, 15 years about the increased funding needed for R&D. I would say that that is a role for the federal government to be able to invest in R&D. The other thing I would say is that it needs to be a long-term investment. One of the problems, personally, I think, with the budget cycles is that it's year to year, and federal agencies just don't know what they're going to get in the next year, so they can't plan ahead of time, and R&D doesn't happen in 1 year. You don't reap the benefits of research in 1 year. You sometimes don't even reap it in 10 years, and so in having a long-term strategy for investment into R&D is very important, and that's a role of the federal government. I also think that echoing a little bit from the recent work by the Advanced Manufacturing Partnership and PCAST on manufacturing is that there needs to both be a strategy and a set of technologies and enabling technologies that the U.S. government decides to support and invest in. And one of the indicators of that we see is investment in shared infrastructure. This is sort of the argument of market failure. You know, the U.S. needs to be investing, or the government can invest in places where the markets can't pick it up, and shared infrastructure and facilities. And we talked about that a little bit earlier, how these are very capital intensive, very expensive facilities. And so that is a place where the government can step in. And we see that in, you know, a $1 billion request for shared infrastructure with these manufacturing innovation institutes in particular subject areas, additive manufacturing, lightweight materials, some of these areas where there is a belief that the R&D can help support and enable new innovations and technology.
Well, you know, I work for Congress, so I don't want to be jumping on anybody's particular bandwagon here. I do want to make one comment, though, about many of these proposals to improve manufacturing. that does concern me, and that is that they're often sold in the context of creating manufacturing jobs. And I'm not sure that this is necessarily realistic. For example, we're hearing now a lot about additive manufacturing. I think people are familiar with this concept. The government has supported a project to promote additive manufacturing based out in Youngstown, Ohio, I believe. This is the idea that essentially you're using printers to make materials from the bottom up rather than using machine tools to slice and drill materials from the top down. And this is a really interesting idea. It's an innovation that is going to have a lot of implications. It's not clear to me, though, whether additive manufacturing creates jobs. It may well not. Okay. Additive manufacturing is certainly going to create jobs for the programmers because the printers that make these products are driven by software, and you'll have to design, you'll have to write a program, essentially, for each product you wish to make. It may create some jobs for material scientists because the machinery can use different types of materials to make different types of products, and there's probably going to be a lot of experimentation in terms of what is the best material to make a particular product with, and there may be some work there. But the machines themselves are going to be computer-driven, so you're not going to have a lot of folks down on the factory floor tending these 3D manufacturing machines is effectively what they are. That doesn't mean that this is a bad idea. It doesn't mean that there's anything at all wrong with additive manufacturing, but it may not do what some people have claimed it would do in terms of creating jobs for factory workers.
Right, which gets us back to that sort of first question of, is there a future in that? I mean, is this an idea, and I would love it if you would jump in on this too, Asha, is this an idea that that a certain type of job with certain levels of skills is going away, and that what we really need to be doing is training more people for the R&D jobs?
So what I would say to that is it's very clear that as the manufacturing floor and the factory floor, as we heard in the last session, it doesn't look the way we conceive of it to look. It's not dirty. It's not everybody's not just sitting there, you know, working with their hands. I think it's very computer intensive. I think it's very IT heavy. I think that the typical manufacturing worker is going to have to be more of a troubleshooter in terms of something breaking down in IT and computing than they are necessarily going to be, you know, hitting nails and screwing things, screwing bolts together. So I think the conception of a worker is no longer the same as it used to be. I also think that automation is continuing to happen. Investment in robotics and automated factories and factories of the future don't necessarily tend to have more people on the factory floor. So you're going to be having a lot more people doing IT-intensive work, modeling and simulation type of work. And so I do think there's an upskilling that's happening, and there's been reports and discussions on the fact that people are going to have different skills to be working on sort of the factories of the future.
I want to open it up to audience questions in just a minute, but before I do that, I wanted to ask each of you, help us look ahead here. What's the future look like for advanced manufacturing, for manufacturing employment, for all of these questions we're talking about, again, as it relates to American competitiveness?
I would say a couple things here. One is that to a certain extent, the United States here is on the leading edge. We tend to lament a lot the decline of manufacturing in the United States. It's worth taking a look internationally. You know, if you go back over the period 1991 to 2011, the decline in manufacturing employment in the United States was right in line with the decline in manufacturing employment in Japan and in Germany, a bit less than in France or in England. So we're not an outlier here in making this transformation from an economy that's driven by a lot of people on the factory floor to a very advanced, very high-tech sector. I think that U.S. manufacturers have done better than those in a number of countries in terms of moving away from simple mass production. Most of our companies now don't simply specialize in making a lot of one thing. Okay, that business has pretty much moved offshore. Why? Because there's not an opportunity to bring to bear the strengths that the United States has in terms of R&D and innovation, and it's simply more economical to build a big plant that's going to stamp out a million of the same thing every month in some other place. So I think that we're well along in this transformation of manufacturing. Really, I think the policy question that I hear constantly in this is, what does this do for low-skilled workers? Where are they left in this? And on that front, I really can't be encouraging. There's really nothing going on in manufacturing that is going to offer jobs for high school dropouts or, for that matter, even high school graduates who don't go on for further education. This is, for those of you who don't keep track of anniversaries, this year is the 100th anniversary of Henry Ford's first assembly line in Highland Park. And the number of workers, as best I can tell from the government's data, the number of people who actually work on assembly lines at this point in time is just a little bit over a million. Okay, it's pretty small. It's well under 1% of the workforce. So this traditional job of what manufacturing workers do, this is pretty much on its way out. And we're really headed into a very different world, which has created a lot of opportunities for some people, but it's not a situation that's going to create a lot of opportunities for people who don't have training and an ability to learn a lot of skills.
So I'm gonna sort of echo a little bit about what Mark said. I do think that the way we look into the future is going to look very different than the past. And one of the things that I think is inherently linked is this idea of manufacturing and services. I also think that computationally enabled workers are going to be very important for the future as well, whether they be in the service sector or in the manufacturing sector. What I would love to see is, from as a data wonk, more data on this change to be able to capture some of these changes, because using the current systems that we have, it just doesn't capture the flavor of how globalization is changing and the look of manufacturing. I would also say that in the future in the U.S., it may actually be that there are certain enabling technologies that hopefully do stay here and hopefully do get innovated. I mean, we are very good at innovating, and the sky isn't falling probably as, it's not as dark as everybody thinks it is, partially because of the data issue, I would say. But the U.S. manufacturing sector is still very vibrant, and one of the areas that we haven't touched on is small and medium-sized manufacturers. And, of the manufacturing establishments, 84% of them are small and medium-sized businesses, which is, I think, defined by 500 workers or less, and they represent 51% of manufacturing employment, the 11 or 12 million that we have. And so they are very, very critical to seeing the wave of the future, and they are more agile. These companies are more agile in innovating and in doing more product innovation. It may not necessarily result in the more traditional employment of a manufacturing worker, but it will probably result in hopefully sustained jobs in both manufacturing and services related.
Awesome. Okay, so let's start. I guess we'll start in the back, the gentleman in blue, and we'll move forward. We got a lot of time for questions.
Don Lindsay, George Washington University. We don't hear much about aftermarket services, certainly, that have to take place, ongoing repairs, coming up with new solutions. How much innovation can take place in the aftermarket servicing, and is it being captured in the data?
I think it's a good point. I mean, this is what people in business tend to think of to a certain extent as the Gillette model, right? You give away the razors, and then over the next years you sell a lot of blades. And there's a lot of this going on. I mean, you've got many companies now that really get most, if a very large proportion of their revenues, not actually making the products, but maintaining the products, providing replacement parts for the products, and look at it as an annuity. If you can get the customer hooked on your product, you've got 10 or 20 years of revenues coming in the door. The extent to which those are captured in the statistics is quite unclear. The manufacturing statistics, not to bore you with the details, are based on two different kinds of surveys. One is establishments, and whether the workers show up as manufacturing workers depends entirely on the location where they're housed. So if the workers who are doing the sort of service you're talking about have their office in a factory, maybe it's upstairs above the factory floor, they'll show up as manufacturing workers. If they have their office in an office park away from the factory floor, they won't show up as manufacturing workers. The other source, obviously, is the household survey. And again, you don't know exactly how these workers think of themselves. As they're going, if they're going to a factory every day, even though their job isn't production, they may well tell the surveyor that they're manufacturing workers. If they're actually not in the trenches of making things every day, they may say, no, I do service and repair, and they may not show up as manufacturing workers. And so it's really hard statistically to put those together.
I haven't seen necessarily data that's able to capture this aftermarket services as of yet.
Okay. Right up here in the front.
Yeah, my name is Pat Malloy. I'm a trade lawyer. I'm not an economist. But my understanding is the formula for GDP consists of investment, consumption, government procurement, and net exports, meaning that net exports is the difference between imports and exports, and that when you run a deficit in net exports, it detracts from your GDP and job growth in this country. My further understanding is most of the United States trade deficit, which is massive, over $3 trillion over the last 20 years, most of it is in manufactured goods. So we're consuming manufactured goods in this country. There's a demand, but we're not making them. We're importing them. And that further puts us in an international debt situation because we're sending dollars out of the country, which are future claims on the American company, the American economy. I think the Chinese purchase of Smithfield is just a sign of what may be coming with all of these dollars now outside the country controlled by a government like China. So I just wanted to get your understanding. Isn't manufacturing very important for this country to have a strategy so that we're not running these huge, massive, ongoing trade deficits in manufactured goods?
I'm not going to express a view on the desirability of a manufacturing strategy or not. That's really not something I'm comfortable doing. I would point out something, though, with respect to the manufacturing trade numbers, which have become increasingly problematic. The reason for that is that an increasing share of the value of manufactured goods is not in the physical production, the actual transformation that occurs by assembly or stamping or molding or whatever, but it's in the intellectual property. And this doesn't show up very well in the trade data. So if you take a computer that's imported into the United States, this will show up as an import based on the value of the computer. But much of the intellectual content in that computer, the designs for the computer, the designs for the chips, whatever, may have been created in the United States and licensed by a U.S. company to somebody in one country who licensed it to somebody in another country, may or may not have been within the same corporation. And we have no track of that chain. So we actually can't say how much of the value of that computer consisted of intellectual property that was originally generated by Americans here in the United States. And that makes the trade data not necessarily very helpful in terms of understanding the current situation of manufacturing.
Despite what you're saying,
That's how the theory says that that's how it's supposed to work. That then they can use those dollars to buy services or goods that we make here. I mean, tourism, for example, is a big American service that counts as a net export.
That counts as an export.
So if someone from Germany buys, if we buy a German product, and that dollar goes to Germany, and then Germans come in and vacation in Florida, that's a net export.
Let me try to explain this in one other way. There's a lot of attention now to attempting to measure the value added in manufactured products. And on international standard, the United States stacks up pretty well. If you take a look at U.S. exports, the share of the value of U.S. exports that was added in the United States is much greater than the same figure for most other countries. So if you're looking at U.S. exports, you're looking at probably somewhere 70 to 80% of the value having been added in the United States. If you're looking at Chinese exports, you may be looking at 30% of the value having been added in China. Okay. So that won't be revealed by the trade data. And I think you just need to consider that in terms of understanding the economic impacts here.
All right. Next question, all the way in the back there.
Hi, my name is Jay Bowie. I'm with the Community College of Baltimore County, about an hour north of here, and I run the manufacturing programs for the Community College. And I just got a question related to your comments on R&D and investment as related to investments by the education community. Many former schools have made investments over the years, and they've shrunk. Community colleges and universities need to make an argument for investment. And that argument has been of recent good wages, good opportunities, while in the past it was more about numbers, and you've already touched on that. But kind of underlying all of that is what you might call the multiplier effect, and I think you've sort of touched on it a little bit. And my question is, does the panel think that this is a valid argument for educational institutions arguing for more investment in manufacturing training and manufacturing education? Can it be a viable argument when we say if we train one worker, a highly skilled worker, and that person is actually helping support another person in advertising, R&D, and other investments? Just like to get the panel's comments.
Asha, do you want to start with that?
Sure. I think that the $1 to $1.35 spillover isn't necessarily supporting one worker, and it's going to, you know, It's more of a investment of dollar argument. I do think though that I'll be very honest. I still haven't found really great data to help me understand the discussion of we have so many people who are unemployed who have skills and are not able to find jobs, and reports from a lot of different organizations saying that we need more highly skilled workers. There's 600,000 unfilled jobs right now. I understand that. The only thing I can say about that is I do think it's not as black and white as saying we have all these people that can't find jobs and we need high skills. I think it's much more narrow than that. In certain fields, in certain areas, we need welders to do this very high-tech type of welding, and we cannot find those types of welders. And so I think that it's really a supply and demand model, but it's not, you can't just put a big generalization around it and saying, because it just doesn't make sense to me, where, you know, we do have high unemployment, a lot of people are being laid off, and at the same time, we hear from a lot of manufacturers that we're not able to find good people. I don't know if that answers your question.
But let me toss out one other thing in that regard, and I'm not an education specialist, but there's something that I find pretty interesting in the employment data in manufacturing. If you can think of two basic kinds of associate's degrees, one is an occupational degree, which essentially gives you a certification. Okay, you're now qualified to do this. And the other is what's known as an academic associate's degree, which, among other things, entitles you to go on to a four-year college if you want to. What's happened over the past decade is a very divergent trend in employment among these two groups in manufacturing. Even though they've shed millions of workers, manufacturers have actually increased employment of people with academic associate degrees, while they have sharply decreased employment of people with occupational associate degrees. Now, you may know better than I what to make of this, but one of the things you might think about here is that you presume a more academic associate degree focuses not just on skills, but on reasoning and thinking abilities, problem-solving abilities, and that those are things valued by manufacturers. And so they are more interested in hiring those people than they are interested in hiring people who have simply learned a skill and gotten a certificate that says, I know this skill.
All right, next question. We'll go... right there in the blue, in the glasses.
My name is Marvin Guerrero. I'm with the Program in American Global Economy with the Woodrow Wilson Center. And during this discussion, and linking it back to the panel discussion before, my question would be how you would define a manufacturing job, because it seems like there's a very blurry line between what was talked about before and what you mentioned as the factories of the future, and that touches on the education issue as well, and also the value added problem of definition with exports and how that relates back to what value is actually added. So manufacturing, to me, it seems like in this discussion covers two things, the production stages and also the stage that comes right before the production stage, so innovating and producing the product, which also links to the difference between academic and occupational education. Where would you draw the line, and what would you think is the impact it has on future employment?
So I would say that the manufacturing job, the part that comes before manufacturing, and there's sort of two different things. There's the hypothetical that we're talking about, and then there's the where the way the statistics bear out. And what I've been sort of saying is that they're different and they're diverging. In terms of the step before sort of the production floor, that R&D space, that's not captured in the manufacturing occupation necessarily. And so when you're talking about product development, R&D, those are all considered services, I believe. So that might address this one concern. I think when I'm talking about IT and computing and some of these other types of fields that are starting to become more and more important on the manufacturing factory floor, that would probably, I'm not exactly sure where that would be captured, to be quite honest with you. It just depends on how that company is surveyed and how they respond to their surveys with respect to the employment on their factory floor. So I do think that there's a little bit of a conundrum here where the data may not be really keeping up with how manufacturing is really conceived of.
I think that's true. But even of the people who work in manufacturing establishments, only 39% of them actually have anything to do with production. Okay. 61% of the people who work in manufacturing establishments do management, sales, finance, research, service, maintenance, transport. They don't actually make things. So there's an awful lot that goes on in the manufacturing sector that is not directly related to physical production.
And also on that point, when you look at a manufacturing establishment, you can only be in one place, either manufacturing or not. And so a company, let's say IBM, is perhaps listed as a manufacturing establishment, but 70% of what they do is software services. And so it's not very clear that they're actually doing manufacturing the way we're thinking about it. But many of their software services could be going to support manufacturing and production.
All right. The gentleman right behind our last questioner.
Thank you. Elias Shecker with REMI. I'm an economic consultant. The first thing I want to do is make a comment. See, the people from the previous panel were urging me to become a welder because apparently I can make over $100,000. And the ones at this panel are saying something completely different. Besides the point, as we're talking about fortifying manufacturing competitiveness at a global scale, I want to know, how would you define competitiveness? What metric are you using for that in order to assess the current state of our competitiveness? And if, after that, define whether or not we should be making any specific policies to address that.
That's a big question.
For my part, I don't use the word competitiveness because I think it's got the precise fuzziness that you're referring to. It's not really a term that's filled with meaning, so it's one I avoid using. I'll pass on the policy question.
I would say I'm going to kind of echo back to what I've seen people do to define competitiveness, and it's not just one thing. So I think by saying the U.S. is losing its competitive edge also has a lot of danger in saying that, because there's places that the U.S. does quite well by certain indicators, and there's areas that other countries may be doing things and rising up. And it may not be that the U.S. is falling. It just might be that other countries are now getting better. And so relatively speaking, we're not looking as good compared to. So things like tax, trade, policy, those are things that people cite as places where, you know, competitiveness and growth and innovation is important. Areas of workforce development and skills training, that's another area that people cite as important. R&D investment, time to market, IP policies. So there is a whole host of indicators that people look at to try and assess the health of a nation, in which the U.S. is not, the sky isn't falling in all of those indicators. With respect to your welding sort of point, I think everybody's going to go out and look into welding programs at this point. But I think that it's also, it's again, this narrow, high-skill area where there may be a demand in a certain type of welding, and that might be very true. And I've heard that from other people, not just people on the last panel. I've heard that specifically about welders. At the same time, that can't translate to every other skill out there. And so I do think that when we look at supply and demand, it needs to be in a very sort of narrow occupational field.
I would answer your competitiveness question, but because I'm sort of a professional pessimist in economics writing right now, with two things that I think should concern everyone about America economically. The first is that our potential GDP growth is falling. Potential GDP is falling. The sort of amount of economic output we think is possible for us to have is going down, some of which is for demographic reasons, but some of which isn't, and is really starting to concern a lot of economists. And the second is that median incomes in this country have stagnated and have done so for a long time. It's basically the median household income in America today is basically where it was at the end of the 80s, if you adjust for inflation. And that's very counter to the experience of the decades before that. Those are the two things that when I think about the kind of America that I want my kid to grow up in, concern me, and that I think concern a lot of the economists that I talk to. We probably have time for one more question. So let's see, try to get someone who hasn't asked anything so far. The gentleman just right here in the beard. Or back there.
Okay, I need some help in trying to figure out where we're going on this. It's either very hopeful or very horrible.
It could be both.
And it could be both. I hear that we need a paradigm shift in terms of the meaning of work, the meaning of money, the meaning of intellectual property, and even the meaning of the social contract. Statistics can be made to do anything you want, we talked in some of the panels about the miracle of what happened to Kodak rediscovering itself. But Kodak went bankrupt last year, and it's a mere shadow of its former self. They basically owned Rochester, New York, and now they've got a few hundred employees. Apple, the distortion field that Steve Jobs had, worked miracles, but now they've lost half their market capitalization. Now China and India and Japan think they're in more trouble than we are, even though we're number five in number of educated scientists and technicians in the world who speak English. So how do we take this and make it into a renaissance rather than the end of history? Any ideas on what that paradigm shift of the meaning of work, the meaning of money, and all those other things needs to be in order to survive ourselves so we don't just be selling hamburgers to each other?
Everybody's looking at me.
this is for the moderator who studied economics at the Washington Post, I guess.
Thank you.
So I'm going to give you the best possible answer, which is a cliffhanger, which is that I actually have a series on that very question that's going to come out in the fall. So stay tuned. That's true, by the way. I didn't just invent a series for myself. I hope my editors believe me. But thank you all for coming and for your great questions. Thanks to a wonderful panel. You were fantastic. My friend and former colleague, Sophie, bring your panel on up.